Well, members, believe it or not, I don't think this has to do with budget problems, but
it is.
this is what I have for my gavel. Meeting will come to order. We thought there was a gavel on the cart and somebody helped themselves to it or something. I don't know. So, at any rate, we have a quorum, and in an unusual turn of events, we're actually going to hear a bill today that is relatively non-controversial and that is first on our agenda. But before that, in other committees, you've been asked to make speeches. We have too much work to do today, so I'm not interested in speeches, but we will do a quick introduction. Just very quickly, and mostly so that staff gets to know the members, because we do have some new staff, and Representative Murphy, we will begin with you. And one of the things that might be helpful for others is just to indicate briefly whether you have previously served on Capitol Hill.
I'm Mary Murphy. I'm state representative from District 6B, which is South St. Louis County and Northeast Carlton County. And I've served on the bonding committee for a long time. Representative Collis was my first chair, I think, maybe one before him, and then Representative Collis, and then Representative Knobloch, and all those Republicans, and then Representative Hausman.
Representative Pawlowski.
Yes, Gene Pawlowski, Houston, Monona Counties, yes.
Matt Dean, Northern Washington County. This is my third term in capital investment.
Joe Mullery, North Apple, North Minneapolis. Never been on it.
Lauren Goldberg, Taken, Grand Rapids, Itasca County area. Yeah, been on a long time. It's one of my favorite chairs.
Bonding committee.
We'll do the staff as we go around.
I'm Deb Dyson from House Research.
And I can tell you that in your packet, you have some of Deb Dyson's fine work. And this is we won't be referencing today. It is for your files. You take that to your office, particularly if you haven't served on the committee. It's Bonding 101. It's anything you would want to know and would be a good resource. And so we thank you for your work on that.
And I'm State Representative Bev Scalzi, and I represent five suburban communities all in Ramsey County, directly north of the Capitol, about 7 miles. My second term on this committee.
I'm Lori Nistel. I'm the committee legislative assistant.
With much experience in the legislature on a number of committees. Alice Houseman, Ramsey County.
Jenny Nass, committee administrator.
Larry House, Cass Crowley, and Hubbard Counties, the only Republican north of St. Cloud. I get to sit next to the best CA and a freshman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Greg David. I represent Fillmore and Houston Counties. I'm a freshman. I serve quite a few terms on the bonding committee.
I'm Corinne Zewers, Health Fiscal Staff.
Rick Hansen, Northern Dakota County, second term on the bonding committee.
Jean Wagenia, South Central Minneapolis, and I've been on the bonding committee for one term.
Representative Maury Lanning, the other Republican north of St. Cloud, second term on his committee.
Dean Erdahl, Meeker and Wright County, six townships in Wright County, and this is my third term on capital investment.
Cassie Nelson, House Research.
Al Junkie, Candiola County, and along with Lynn Carlson, was the only member to be at all 21 committee tours last year. Perfect attendance for Teacher Carlson and me.
I'm Mike Ballou. I'm the Republican researcher for the committee.
And I'm Lyndon Carlson, the I go back with capital investment issues when they were handled through the old appropriations committee. So if I were to count that time, probably 30-some years, but I was on a leave of absence. Something happened a few years ago, and I was on an 8-year sabbatical, is the way I would put it. So, choice of mine. think we went into the minority yet. Oh, and I represent Robinson for the hotel.
I represent Tim Mahoney. I represent the northeast corner of the city of St. Paul, 67A, and two or three or four terms on the bonding committee. I can't remember.
Thank you, Scott. I'm a freshman this year. I represent Andover and Hamlake, District 49A.
And I don't really count Representative Davids as a freshman, and so I so she is our only freshman on the committee.
Madam Chair, I'm the only freshman that served on this committee for many, many years.
And Noah Radke, DFL Conference.
Karen Clark, I represent three inner city neighbors in South Minneapolis, and this is actually, I think, my second term. I had a pause in between two.
And we have two pages. So we're happy to have you, and I think we got everyone. So thank you, and we did send out an email inviting members to visit about their personal goals, and several of you have already done that. A few more have requested, so we'll look forward to continuing that if there are people who just want to visit about what you hope to see accomplished. We have House File 56 before us, and this is one of those, I say it's non-controversial, I hope it is. It's unusual for us to quickly introduce ourselves and have a bill. You may recall a few years ago that we had something similar. This is a, as you will note, a bipartisan effort. Haas, Haas, Gottwald, and Severson, and the Senate author is Fischbach. Representative Haas, I will move House File 56 be recommended to pass and be referred or returned to the Finance Committee. And just have you, I think you've brought some, a local person with you, Chuck Woken or Walken. And we aren't interested in a lot of time, so just tell us what the problem is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for your consideration this afternoon. This is purely a technical bill to deal with an interpretation that the Department of Revenue has some difficulties with releasing some bond proceeds for the purchase of property in Stearns County. In order to make Mr. Wilkins' trip necessary, I would like to pass over any explanation to him.
Welcome to the committee.
Chuck Wilkins, Stearns County Park Director and a member of the Central Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Coordination Board. When this bill was authored, we assumed that the Central Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails and Coordination Board could receive this grant, and the intention was to administer it according to state statute to Stearns County for implementation to expand Warner Lake Park by 23 acres. And then we hit the interpretation difficulty, and because the coordination board at this point can't technically own property, it can only administer grants. It was decided that we needed to come back and change the recipient to Stearns County.
And I saw in an email that Representative Gottwald sent that there's a pending purchase agreement, so there was some eagerness to move quickly with this. This is not new authorization. In other words, this was passed by both houses last year. It was signed by the governor, and this changes the party that received the funding. Any questions? Representative Carlson.
The author or whoever would be most knowledgeable about what is the timeline that you have to be
looking
at questions for because there is two more stops before the bill would get the House floor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have an active purchase agreement that we have to renegotiate because we expected to own the property by now. The seller is willing to work with us, and the time frame to recognize the legislative timetable.
No further questions. I will renew my motion that House File 56 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, a unanimous vote, and you are on your way. There's two more stops, and we hope that happens quickly for you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Today, we have a bit of an introduction to State Bonding Authority and a couple of other things. You'll learn what a bond cancellation report is all about, and also you'll hear about some exciting news about this morning, a little bit of good news in what's a grim time. So if Kathy Cardell and Mike Roloff would come to the table, I think you're presenting all three of our agenda items today. Welcome to the committee. And I believe we're starting with the, and I, my understanding is that Jim Showalter is also in the audience and is available, or is that?
I don't believe he's going to be here today. I think he'll be here on Thursday, is my understanding, Madam Chair.
And we're going to begin with the update on the bond sale.
Yes, as Madam Chair pointed out this morning, several members of the committee were in our offices over in the Centennial Building, where we took bids electronically over the internet for state general obligation bonds. This is a sale that was originally and normally would have occurred in October of last year, but the market was, we'll use a polite term, extremely dysfunctional, and really for the balance of the latter quarter of the fourth quarter of 2008. So we made a decision to defer the sale and targeted this particular date as the next best opportunity to go forward. So this morning we took bids on three separate series of bonds. The largest, $325 million of various purpose capital, for various purpose capital projects. That's the project, that's everything from University of Minnesota and MinSCU and DNR and DEED and so forth. We received six bids on those bonds, and the true interest rate from the winning bidder, which was Merrill Lynch, was a 3.50%. And I've given you summaries of all three of the bid results, but you can see one of the things that's very encouraging for us is the fact that those bids actually were very close. And that was one of the problems that we were seeing last fall, which is frankly that market participants didn't know what the interest rate market really was, and so we were seeing very wide disparities in bids. The second issue was very important to MnDOT, $70 million of general obligation trunk highway bonds. That issue received seven bids. You'll note on the summary of the results that the second place bidder, which is RBC Capital Markets, is shown as the firm that received the award. And again, those that attended this morning, on the first bid opening, we talked about conforming and non-conforming bids. The Merrill Lynch bid was a non-conforming bid
because
their interest rate spread from one maturity to the next exceeded the 1% limitation that we specify in our notice of sale. So we had a little excitement. We got to call them and advise them. They understood what their error was. And so we awarded to the first best conforming bid, which was presented by RBC Capital Markets. That was a true interest rate of 3.47%. And then the last piece was a small $5 million taxable financing. It's a general obligation bond. That issue is taxable because it provides funding for the Rural Finance Authority's loan programs to individual farmers. This issue actually received nine bids, and the winning bidder was a local firm, Cronin and Company, out of Minneapolis, at a 3.07%. Again, that's a taxable rate. It's a five-year maturity, bullet maturity, what we call a bullet maturity, which it was maturing in 2013. We were just very, very pleased and so glad that we could go forward with these sales successfully this morning. I can't tell you how good it's going to feel to sleep, hopefully, tonight. So.
Now, just to help members understand, going back to the first page, help us understand why that is a little bit of good news for us and how it will affect the February forecast.
Absolutely. At the time of the November forecast, we made the assumption that we would be able to sell these bonds in January, but we utilized interest rates that were provided by Global Insight, EII, the economics firm that we work with in developing the broader revenue expenditure forecast. And the interest rate that we used, that they recommended that we use, was a 5% interest rate. So the much lower rate that we received today is very good news, because in the February forecast now, we will be able to adjust the debt service costs related to these bond issues downward, which will all take whatever downward costs we can achieve. So.
Representative Davis has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's say we're a year back, go back a year,
mm-hmm.
and $325 million of GO bonds are sold to Lehman Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Where would we be today on those? How does that work?
Well, a year ago, I've only been in this position since February, so I can talk to you about the only other bond sale that I've participated in, which was our July bond sale, which actually was purchased by Lehman Brothers at about a 3.92%, I believe. And so the market actually was better. Interest rates were lower than what we received back in July.
So, Madam Chair, and to the person, what was your name again?
I'm sorry, it's Kathy Cardell, Assistant Commissioner.
Oh, Assistant Commissioner, okay.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question is, what happens if one of these companies that bought these bonds goes down and they're not there anymore?
Madam Chair, Representative, the bonds, the companies that purchased these bonds, as some of you may know, Merrill Lynch has actually successfully closed on an acquisition with, I believe, Wachovia Bank. And so I don't think that there's any risk that they're going to be going away. In fact, their credit ratings were actually just raised as a result of their successful merger. All of these companies, we'll close on the bonds at the end of January, actually January 27th. And, they're providing us a good faith deposit. It's a de minimis amount of money that we would retain in the event that they were unable to perform at closing. I do not have any expectation that any of these firms are going to suffer any issues.
Well, Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner, I mean, not to mention names, but like Barclays or Citigroup, I mean, well, let's go back to Lehman Brothers. They went down. They're not there anymore. Where did the bonds go?
But the bonds are sold, Madam Chair and Representative, the bonds are sold to other investors. So the way that the market is working, definitely the way the market is working currently, is that they are wanting to sell these bonds immediately.
Okay.
They're not holding a lot of bonds in inventory. And frankly, bonds that Lehman was holding perhaps in inventory have been acquired because they were acquired, their broker-dealer operation was acquired by Barclays. Barclays now took over Lehman.
Madam Chair, who owns Barclays now?
Barclays
went down too.
Madam Chair, no, Barclays has not gone down. Barclays is an English bank.
But part of Barclays went away. Sorry, Madam Chair. Part of Barclays did something.
Right. Ms. Cardell?
Madam Chair.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Madam Chair, how do you like to be Lehman Brothers? I mean, the only one that doesn't get bailed out. Isn't that something?
Madam Chair, Ms. Cardell, in your general obligation bonds that are taxable,
yeah.
It has an interest rate. What is the true effective interest rate for the state in that? Because obviously they'll be paying taxes to the state.
Yeah,
do you figure that out?
The rate that we have cited here, Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, is the actual true interest rate that we will pay. The rate that I think maybe you are referring to is the effective rate for an individual. They're effectively getting paid a 3.07% for a five-year obligation, which is quite honestly very good when you think about where five-year or two-year treasury yields are, other comparable taxable yields, where, I mean, some of those have been in the 1% range.
But I'm sure my question is, they do pay taxes on that. So are we able to figure out the true effective rate of the state because some of that money will come back to the state in the form of taxes?
I'm not sure, Madam Chair. I'm sure that there's someone probably in the Department of Revenue that could do that calculation.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
No further questions. I think we'll then move on to the overview of the capital budget process. And my understanding, Mr. Roloff, is
Do you want to keep going with debt management, Madam Chair, since it's on the screen? Or would you prefer? Does it matter?
Well, I think we. I mean, on Thursday, we're spending the entire time on debt management guidelines. I don't know if that is part of your overview of the capital budget process. Is that...
Madam Chair, my presentation is really more of an overview of the state's debt management practices, not including the debt management guidelines, since we have targeted a special hearing, more so for perhaps members who are less familiar with the bonding process.
I think I'll ask you to use your judgment. We actually have press and others interested in that Thursday. The debt management guidelines have been in discussion the last couple of years, so there's a lot of interest. So if it sets the background to that, it might be more helpful, because there will be people at that hearing that aren't at this one. I think I would ask you to use your judgment then on whether that's appropriate for Thursday or today.
Madam Chair, I think we'll go ahead and we'll have Mike Roloff do the process, and perhaps I do think if there is time, there are some elements of the presentation that I've brought for today that could be helpful to set some background for people before Thursday.
Good. So we will have the overview of the capital budget process. Mr. Roloff, sure. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Roloff. I'm a executive budget coordinator at the Department of at MMB.
Not really.
And the capital budget assignment is on my team. So another way of saying that is I was Jane Rankin's supervisor, if you remember Jane. So Jane is no longer with us, so you get the second team in today. And I was also going to mention that if Ms. Dyson has a bonding 101 in your packet, it's probably all the right answers of the things that I can confuse you with.
I think
Madam Chair and Representative, I know that there is a plan to statutorily change the name, but I don't know what the... Madam Chair and Representative, right now we're only really using electronic versions.
that's not true. I got a letter.
No, that's because we printed it off, but it's not printed stationary. It's
color.
I know, we can print it in color. We can print it in color.
The computer did it.
The computer does it. Yes.
It just meant they did one copy as opposed to.
And Madam Chair, I will say.
I think our case is having a little trouble. I need a gavel. I need a gavel today.
I would think that everything that we're doing, for example, in conjunction with the bond sale, we continue to do under the auspices of the Department of Finance, since that is still the legal name.
Okay, Madam Chair. This is just some overviews of the capital budget process. Our goals in running a capital budget process are to create a common list of state agency and local government capital projects for the decision makers. And that includes both the governor's office and the legislature. And when we say common list, we're talking about beyond just the list, but we're trying to get a common format, a common set of base information, so that to the extent possible, as you're looking at the information on the capital budget project, you can do apples to apples comparisons, but you know that they're all working kind of from the same base, so that you're allowed to evaluate and select capital projects as easily as possible. Two parts of the capital budget. This is the part we call the major capital budget, and that is the one that is presented to the legislature in the even numbered years, and that's what I'll spend most of the time talking about today, but I will talk a little bit later in the presentation about how the capital budget process this year might be different.
If we could go just back to that previous page, members, that some on this committee serve also on a capital restoration task force that's been trying to get our hands around what's got to be done in that building. And to that first issue, what we've learned is some states have an ongoing, just the same budget amount for asset preservation for state buildings that they just assume happens on a regular basis. If you've been on this committee for a while, you know that asset preservation line in all the state agencies doesn't really turn people on, and so it is very often one that that doesn't make it through the process. And yet, if you think about that very first point, keeping state property and state buildings sound, certainly for the long term, is something we ought to take seriously, and that's how some states do it, that they just say every year we're going to have a set amount that we assume is going to be bonded for asset preservation.
Let me go back one. Like I said, we're talking primarily about the even numbered years, and we'll get more into the process, and we'll also talk about the how it might look different in the odd numbered years. The capital budget process that is coordinated by MMB really is guided by the state constitution and by state statutes. The state constitutional requirements as they pertain to bonding are in Article 9, Section 5. There are several state statutes that guide how the capital budget is supposed to be presented. There are 16A11, how we present and when we present budgets to the legislature. 16A86 is how do we include local governments with, or grant to local governments within this capital budget process. And then also 16A502, which is some requirements that we make sure that all of the funds are lined up for a capital project before they begin the project. This next slide is actually, we thought we were going in the other order, so Kathy was going to give you a little bit more detail about this, but this is kind of in a nutshell what the capital, what the Constitution says about capital budget projects. Number one is they have to have public ownership. I think in yours you will find my first typo, which is publicly ownership. I guess I wanted to emphasize it twice or something. But for it to, it has to have public ownership. It has to be a capital expenditure. So that means it's creation of an asset or improvement of an asset or some kind of a capital asset. It has to be a public purpose. And the purpose for it must be clearly set forth in law, and that's quite often kind of a difficult thing to get your hands around. The bill you just heard is kind of an example of that. Mm-hmm. It was specified in law one way under a certain set of assumptions, but it didn't work that way. So we had to come in, pass an amendment, refine the purpose of how it was listed in law so that it really meets this challenge. Some of the statutory requirements...
Rivina has a question. Can the public ownership
be run by the nonprofit? Let's say in the case of a community in Midas that owns a nursing home, but the nursing home is run by a nonprofit. Does that qualify for nonprofit?
You want to take that one?
Ms. Cardell.
Madam Chair, Representative Buchanan, there are ways to structure ownership issues and operation issues so that nonprofits can participate. That was an example is the Guthrie Theater project where essentially the city owns the land, they built the project, but they have a use and lease agreement with the Guthrie Foundation, which is a nonprofit entity. So there are ways to do that. Yes, sir.
Now, most of those that I'm familiar with, it has to do with the property. He's really asking the other question, where the property isn't in question. It's the issue of operating.
You can enter into a different types of agreements for a nonprofit to offer. In this case, it would be kind of the public purpose or the public program that's being offered in the facility.
Representative Hanson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On constitutional requirements, would there be, I mean, this is something you can get additional information on, but we just passed a constitutional amendment that has very specific things that it's supposed to spend money on, and the issue has been raised about taking that dedicated source of revenue for revenue bonds. So when you have the constitutional requirements for capital investments and the constitutional, if there was a proposal to capture the revenue from the sales tax for revenue bonds, is that possible to?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, it is revenue. You cannot pay revenue bonds from the proceeds of a generally applied tax. Then it becomes public debt under the Constitution. So in a nutshell, you're not going to be able to use the sales tax revenues under the constitutional amendment to secure revenue bonds.
I have a different version of that question then. Having passed that, could the legislature designate that that is to be debt service for GO bonds?
Madam Chair, that's exactly correct. If we approved a project using general obligation bonds, but we did what we have at least affectionately referred to user financing to pay, if it's through the DNR or another agency that's administering those projects, that would be the way to do it. A revenue bond structure will not work.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. First, with regard to your statements like Kiefer and things like that, if they do it across the board, doesn't that take away from the legislature the power to react to the economic times, such as right now we would want to put a lot of that in because the building trades are sitting on the bench in a year when we've got a lot of travelers in here and there's nobody there, then we'd be stuck putting in more money to get more travelers into Minnesota if we had to do that across the board like some states do.
Travelers. I missed the reference.
Oh, travelers, that's building trades people from other states who are
I thought you were describing the project.
No, I'm saying that if we've got a bunch on the bench, like right now, we would want to put extra into HEAP or whatever, and then years when we've got travelers in here from all over the country, we'd hardly want to put as much in as in other years, but we'd be limited if we had that.
So you're saying you're making an argument against just a set amount for asset preservation, given the fact that priorities might change from year to year.
Then, Madam Chair, my second question, totally different, is can you do bonding for housing through this? Or is that special type of bond?
Ms. Cardell.
Madam Chair, Representative, the way that the Constitution is, I'm not sure what you're meaning in terms of housing, but the agency that really administers financing for single-family mortgages and other types of residential housing finance is the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and they issue revenue bonds for that purpose. I think it would be difficult to do a housing, unless I'm misunderstanding what you might be having in mind, that would be, you know, have public ownership and have a public program operated within it and so on and so forth. I suppose it's possible, though.
And the legislature just made a change last year relative to this. Minnesota Housing Finance Agency had always come to us for a level of GO bonding for permanent supportive housing. Lucian Social Service and other nonprofits pointed out to us that the rules around bonding are so specific and sometimes restrictive that in one case, for their permanent supportive housing project, they would have had to put in two elevators to meet our rules. And so because MHFA has bonding authority on their own, They argued that that we would do better to say use your own bonding authority, and we commit to the debt service on that on those bonds, and so we made that change in law. Now that does mean that Representative Clark has to carry that debt service in her bill.
Representative Chair, one follow up then could. Let's say with all of the foreclosures going on, could you use the GO bonds to buy up properties that are foreclosed, and then can they later be turned over? Is there a certain number of years you'd have to hold them as a local government or whatever, or as a state?
Ms. Cardell.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would say it would be very difficult to do that given the constitutional requirements, and there's also, which is also in my presentation, the laundry list of other purposes for which CO bonds can be used, and it includes such things as repel invasion or suppress insurrection. We can borrow temporarily if we need to. I'll just skip over like refunding, but we can establish and maintain highways, promote forestation and prevent and abate forest fires, construct, improve, and operate airports, develop the state's agricultural resources, that's where the Rural Finance Authority program comes into play, and improve and rehabilitate railroad right-of-way. So the list, as the chairman said, it's a pretty restrictive and very narrow list of types of projects that are able to be financed with state general obligation bonds.
And so if we finish this overview, I think we're moving fairly quickly. Those broad guidelines would probably be helpful for us to include today. And that might, we can go back, Representative Mullery, to your question after we've had a chance to look at that. Continue.
So we've had some discussion about the constitutional restrictions as it pertains to bonding, and you can see that there's a lot of interpretation and different ways to view things. Some of the statutory elements that guide the bonding process are 16A11 is the main one, and this is when it sets up what must be presented to the legislature and when and how. And it requires a submission date, July 15th, all of the preliminary projects as they have been presented to us get forwarded to you so that you can take a look at them then. And then you can set up your tours so that Representative Junkie and Representative Carlson can go on them. Then on January 15th is when the governor recommends his actual capital budget. Now you can see that those are the only two deadlines that are put in law, but in order to make the process work, then we've obviously got to build some additional deadlines around that. And I'll talk about the basic timeline a little bit later in the presentation.
And I will say that is how Jenny Nash began her process of trying to decide what we were going to do about the tour. She went through the book.
Yep.
And so I've often said to people, the way you get on our radar screen is you go through this process.
It requires that the capital plan has to look at a six-year horizon. The statute requires that the budget, it's different than the biennial budget, it requires that it has to show both the governor's recommendation and the requests that were made by the agencies or the local government, regardless of whether or not the governor recommended them. And it also has to present them actually in the priority order that was established by the agency or the local government, again, regardless of what the governor's recommendation is. We've got a 16A502, which is the commitments to capital projects that we've got to make sure there's full funding before we begin the project. That generally applies to local government projects and local match requirements, but conceivably could apply to a state project if there was like some federal match or something involved with that. And then 16A86, which is how do we deal with capital projects for grants to political subdivisions. We spent a little bit of time talking about some of the difficulties with meeting the constitutional provisions. Most of the agencies who do this routinely are sort of familiar, so they're in the ballpark. Local government agencies who submit requests may or may not know any of this constitutional kind of stuff. And so we spend a lot of time with the local governments talking about those very issues of ownership and public purpose and that kind of thing. The law requires that anything that's submitted to us, we have to submit to the legislature on July 15th, so we don't do a lot of prioritizing of that. By the time the governor's capital budget recommendation comes out, we are asked to look at some specific aspects of each one of the local government projects, and there's a little scoring grid in the format that deals with this, but it's generally that the state share of the project be no more than 50% and the local costs be maximized if possible. We've got to make some kind of a judgment about is it a state mission or not, and does it have regional or statewide significance? Does it expand the state into a new policy rule? Are there operating subsidies that are going to be required? Will it create inequities between jurisdictions, or will it create competitive problems between jurisdictions, local resolutions, and some pre-design requirements? Now, just like with a lot of the stuff we talked about in the constitutional area, there's an awful lot of judgment, a lot of subjectivity in some of those things like statewide purpose, regional significance, competitive conflict with a neighboring community, those types of things. So we try to work those out as best we can. There are some other things that guide the capital budget process. One of them is the state debt capacity guideline. That comes into play at the end of as the governor is putting together his recommendation, or as you guys are coming to the end of the session and putting your bill together. There is some recommended level set by the capital debt capacity guidelines that we try to work within. So that's what kind of draws the line for the decision makers. There are a number of process requirements. I mentioned setting some of the internal deadlines. We require similar types of information on similar types of forms. A lot of stuff that those of you who have been on the committee before have seen in the past capital budget books. I did make some copies of some samples and gave them to Ms. Nash if she would like to pass them out to some of the newer members to kind of look at the formats that you'll be seeing. And we do things like put out a project inflation guideline to make sure that all of the agencies and projects are using the same assumptions about escalating costs over time and all of that. And then we spend a lot of time in kind of a technical assistance role answering some of those same types of questions that we've been discussing here with the people who are requesting capital budget projects. This is the basic timeline of the even year major capital budget proposal. We will be issuing instructions this year sometime in April on for both local governments and for state agencies on how we're going to go about collecting requests. On May 9th, we'll have state agencies begin to enter their project information into our centralized computer system. We call it CBS, Capital Budget System, not a very glamorous name. But we'll set a deadline for mid-June sometime. Last year it was June 15th for state agencies and local projects to have all of their preliminary submission in. And that will allow us to put things together so that we can ship them off to you by July 15th. And clear up some of the problems before we send them to you, hopefully. July 15th, we do the submission to the legislature of all projects. No governor's recommendation at that time. Sometime in mid-October, we will put out a deadline that says all of the descriptions and numbers and everything has to be final within the system, and that will allow us to begin the decision-making process. In November, we will also do the November forecast for the state budget, and as part of that, we will do the debt capacity forecast, and so that will also set the parameter, the size parameter for the capital budget bill. The governor will do his decision-making between November and January. The bill will be, the books and the bill will be presented in January, and then if all goes well, the legislature will pass the bill and the governor will sign it in May sometime, and then we will do some post-enactment assistance. And much like you and your staff do, all through this process, from April all the way through to the time that the bill is passed, we try to learn more about the projects and try to identify anything that we may see as a problem. If it's a problem in language, if it's a problem in the way the project is structured, if it's a problem in the cost analysis, we try to identify that, get that information out to you as quickly as we can. Unfortunately, sometimes we don't find them all until after the bill is enacted.
And the interesting thing, members of the committees I've served on, this bill does seem to get the most intense scrutiny from the time we have that final bill till we take it to the floor. A group of people sit around a table, bond counsel, or maybe you were going to mention that, and look at every word point out problems. Because of the specific nature or the importance of each word, and even so, even with all those experts looking at it, once in a while we have a word or two that isn't right.
I'm going to move on to the off year budget capital process. So, if there are any questions about the main one coming up, this might be a convenient time to handle them.
We'll push on.
Okay. Oops. Okay. In the off-year or the odd-numbered year legislative session, it's a much different process. There is no requirement in statute for the governor to submit a capital budget request in the odd-numbered legislative year. So we don't really do a formal solicitation for projects from the state agencies or from the local government. We don't activate our capital budget system and spend time doing the standard formats and collecting all of the information. We may, in the course of the biennial budget preparation, hear from some agencies who may have capital needs, and we may ask them some questions about them, and then discuss them in that context. And if they would rise to an emergency level, perhaps the governor would recommend a capital budget in the off year. But it's a much, much more informal process.
Representative Carlson has a question.
Just a question. We're all reading an awful lot about economic recovery and infrastructure being a big part of that. Is there anything done or being done currently then to be prepared for the targets of opportunity that come about fairly soon? Be done in a way where we'd be ready to spring with projects that are ready to become very knowledgeable.
Mr. Roloff.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I wouldn't say anything formal is being done. One of the things about the capital budget bill is that there's always a long list of projects that didn't get funded the session before. So there's a long list of areas to go at. There are also things that we know, like the University of Minnesota has said it's going to come forward and try to ask for HEPR money, and that would be ready to go. There's probably some other asset preservation stuff that...
Well, I can tell one of them is actually sitting in the audience. The Minnesota Zoo, I was going to ask you about that. There are some of these agencies that requested much higher amounts for asset preservation.
That's
and
right.
We weren't quite so generous, and so one assumes that that type of thing is still in the pipeline in those agencies.
Correct,
well.
And beyond that, we're, much like you, we're trying to follow and understand as quickly as we can what the federal stimulus package might have and where we might intersect with it.
Representative Carlson, did you have a follow-up?
Well, I
sounds about being a chair, like you didn't rely on what's in the pipeline already, and that you're going to review that and see what would be eligible. With your comments, though, another side comment is that they may even look at K-12 school facilities. And do you see that a role of two of them? How would that potentially be handled as a part of the economic recovery? Because we've got huge in Minnesota on that need. So if the older school buildings and so on, we would fall into that category.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, I would imagine to the extent it became clear what kind of federal match or what kind of state match the federal government might want for that type of a program, we would certainly try to meet that if we could. Beyond that, I really and truly don't know enough about the federal stimulus to comment very much.
I'm not sure. I think that's for all of us. Mm-hmm. Talking about preparation for whatever might happen because they're talking about a certain number of days
Continue.
Okay, and put a slide in about our role after enactment of the bonding bill, part of our financial control obligations. We've got procedures within the state accounting system to set up the project so that they can begin proceeding. And if there are special conditions or match requirements, they are deactivated within the accounting system so they can't proceed until we're sure that those match requirements have been met and that full funding requirement of 16A502. And then again, we're constantly working with agencies and local projects that are coming forward and said, well, the law said this, but here's what we really meant. And we try to see if there's a least way to work it or some way to work it, or do we have to bring it back to the legislature or whatever.
And members, this is the section we'll probably be revisiting. In a few meetings, we're having the legislative auditor in to discuss the 2006 bonding bill was audited. Mm-hmm. And there were quite a number of findings, and really they had to do with this period, didn't they? After the bonding bill was passed, and so we'll have one meeting where we just take a look at those findings and try to determine is there anything we can do in the writing of the bill, or is this part of the management? But I think we're changing that date because the date we had it scheduled, you're not going to be available. So we want to make sure your Representative Hansen is here for that.
And then Kathy, at the last slide, Kathy and I technically work in different parts of the department, even though we used to sit across the aisle from each other. But the capital budget process, the coordinator works within the budget division. Kathy heads up the debt management, but those two groups interact quite a bit. We interact as we're talking about what the debt service, how much debt service should be carried in the forecast. Most of you probably know that historical precedent, we carry an amount sufficient to pay debt service on the average large bonding bill and small, even an odd number of years bonding bill over the past 10 years. And so the current forecast is carrying enough for $120 million for bonding bill this year and $720 for the bonding bill after that, and continues to alternate like that. If a larger bonding bill is passed, then debt service money has to be found in the budget. If a smaller one, there are some savings. We're constantly answering bondability questions. Either we hear it first and bring it to Kathy brings it first, brings it to us for the implementation.
What I realized is I didn't pick up anywhere here one of the other pieces of information that is not always clear is that no one you know, a project, they should not have begun work on it. That once they have begun work on it, it is no longer bondable. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I would say that maybe what I think you may be referring to is if somebody starts work, acquires land, let's say, for a project in advance of the enactment of the bonding bill that authorizes that project, there are some limitations in terms of what we can do to go back and reimburse someone who has moved ahead on their own accord. So that does that answer
your question? What about construction, though?
Same issue.
If they are
financing their costs, or if they're anticipating to ultimately pay for those costs out of the state grant, then we would still have potentially these reimbursement problems for work that is done prior to enactment.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Cardinal, do you carry project by project accounting of how much, if we appropriate, let's say, $10 million for a project and we sell, let's say, this year, $2 million in bonds and we have eight to sell going forward. Do you carry that line by line, and is that available for us?
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, it is. I didn't bring, we're going to talk about hopefully the cancellation report here in a moment, which has a very, very large legal size attachment, which basically goes through every single bonding appropriation that's out there, and we are able to access that in the MAP system. And I would ask Mr. Roloff, that's correct, right? I don't get as involved on the accounting side of it as the budget officers do, but
I will say that, Representative Dean, we've had a number of people ask that very question, so I think we're going to look for Representative Solberg. I think just went to get his, but I do think that it's probably of interest to everyone on the committee, and we'll figure out a way to duplicate that.
And also, Madam Chair, and represent one more point of clarification too, just to make sure that everybody understands. When we sell bonds not on a pure project by project basis. We survey every agency that has open bonding appropriations, and they provide us with their cash flow projections for whichever projects they anticipate will be going forward in the period that we ask them to cover.
One more question, Madam Chair, Ms. Cardell. Could you explain the process by which previously approved bonds are canceled or delayed?
Madam Chair and Representative Dean, actually, I've got a little section on that that we're going to talk about here.
As soon as he finishes, I think we'll do the debt cancellation. Then, if we have time, we'll do your.
Madam Chair, I think I'm finished because the last two bullets are about this post enactment assistance that we talked about that we're going to talk about more when the legislative auditor gets here and a couple of the tools we have. So we can certainly move on.
So why don't we do the bond cancellation report, and we'll give them an idea about when we automatically cancel. And that is, you have a handout in your...
Yes, it's a man sharing, and it's a part of the broader PowerPoint presentation, and I'm going to flip through, and I apologize because there are no page numbers on there. My legislative
person... Well, would you like to just incorporate it when you get to that point?
Is there, Mentor, sufficient time? I don't think
we have about 25 more minutes.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay.
Mentor, I think we'll go ahead and do that.
All right.
I'll flip back to my other earlier page. The very first slide is simply what is a bond? This is just one definition, but in its simplest terms, a bond is an interest-bearing certificate that's issued by governments or other entities when they borrow money. The bond issuer, in our particular case, the state of Minnesota, agrees to pay a fixed principal sum on a specified date or date, which is known as the maturity date, and with interest can be fixed or variable. In the case of our own situation, we only are able to issue fixed rate bonds. We've talked a little bit about some of the types of debt conveniently given the bonds that we sold this morning. in some of the conversation that we've already had in the hearing today. There are general obligation bonds that the state sells. That's by far our largest category of debt. There's also certain revenue bonds. We can issue tax-exempt or taxable bonds. We always try to make our bonds tax-exempt if we can. That saves us cost, lowest interest cost. We can do fixed. I can only do fixed, but others could also do variable rate bonds where the rate is periodically reset. We can also do long-term bonds or short-term bonds. I've just given you a list here of the state bond issuers. This doesn't include some of the quasi-state folks like the University of Minnesota or Metropolitan Council, but you can see that my commissioner, we sell general obligation various purpose bonds, we sell general obligation trunk highway, and we also have a 911 revenue bond program. That's currently the only revenue bond program that we do. We'll talk a little bit about some other types of obligations that we issue in a second. The Public Facilities Authority issues revenue bonds for various loan programs and other purposes. We talked about the Housing Finance Agency. They're a large state bond issuer. The Office of Higher Education sells student loan revenue bonds. MNSCU, they sell revenue bonds that are secured by their revenue bond or their revenue fund, primarily for what we call auxiliary facilities, things like dormitories and student unions and so forth. The Agricultural and Economic Development Authority these days primarily acts as a conduit issuer for others who don't have authority to sell bonds on their own, sometimes nonprofits, hospitals, things like that. They are primarily serving as a conduit right now. We've talked about the Rural Finance Authority, the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Authority. They just currently have a small amount of bonds outstanding for Giants Ridge facilities. The Minnesota State Armory Building Commission, an even smaller amount of bonds outstanding, but they are authorized to sell bonds basically for National Guard armory buildings. And the Minnesota Higher Education Facilities Authority, again, they act as a conduit issuer for private colleges who, again, do not necessarily have the authority to access the bond markets on their own.
Do you have a second page of that? No, you don't. There was a question why the University of Minnesota isn't listed there.
We don't have any. They're not considered to be an obligation of the state, potentially in the same way some of these are, I believe. To be perfectly frank, Madam Chair, I'm not quite sure that I yet still fully grasp the relationship between the university, because we clearly do consult with them on a lot of things that they're doing.
Representative Clark.
Thank you. What agency is the Agricultural and Economic Development Authority bonds located in?
It's a consortium, a group of folks that are represented by, and I apologize, I know that there are representatives from BEAD. Commissioner McElroy is involved in it. There's, I'm trying to remember. Terry, do you remember?
Would people prefer?
Do you want some?
Welcome to the committee, first time this year.
First, I doubt it will be the last. For the record, my name is Terry Coleman, Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. I'm also, when the chair can't chair the meet or the chair of the meeting, I serve as a delegate and chair the MEDA board or Agriculture Economic Development Authority board. It consists of several bankers on the board. There's several state agencies. I know Finance, Deed, and PCA are the three. And they meet when usually it's hospitals or some organization needs tax exempt status on their debt, and they got to have a public sponsor. This board will look at it and make sure it makes economical sense and put their name on it, and they get tax exempt status, but there's really no obligation. They do have a small amount of funds that back some outstanding bonds that they sold several years ago.
Only about $12 million left.
Yeah, pretty small amount.
Thank you. Okay, continue.
There are other types of state obligations. Madam Chair, you had kind of referenced one earlier with Minnesota Housing, but we have several state standing appropriations that are related to bonds that have been or will ultimately be sold by others. The University of Minnesota for the TCF Bank Stadium, and also the biosciences facilities, and the MHFA supportive housing program that you mentioned. We have lease purchase financing for equipment. Our department administers that through our master lease program. Primarily that's used by state agencies and actually other local governments who can piggyback on our really good rates for purchasing cars and trucks and so forth. But it's primarily vehicles, some technology types of things. We have lease purchase financing for real estate. We have a facility up in Bemidji for the BCA that we appropriate debt service for, and we also have Port Authority bonds that were issued by issued on behalf of the state, but to finance the construction of the agriculture building and the DHS building, I believe. Those are considered to be state appropriation credits. We have a very large credit enhancement program for school financing. Currently, there's about $10.4 billion guaranteed under that program for school districts for their various general obligation bonds or certificates of participation. There's never been a draw. A school district has never missed a payment. If there ever was, there is an agreement in place that we would make the payment for them and we would deduct that amount from their state aid or credits. And then there is a city and county credit enhancement program. This was originally just a county program. It was expanded to include certain projects financed by cities. And there's about $337 million of debt guaranteed or enhanced under that program. And those two enhancement programs, it gives the underlying borrowers, whether it's a school district or city or county, the benefit of a higher credit rating, consequently a lower cost of borrowing, hopefully, than what they might be able to achieve without.
Mr. Curdo, you mentioned the BCA building in Bemidji, and mm-hmm. the two down here, the Elmer Allen Anderson building, are those two ag buildings. But you said that so you carry them as a part of your debt capacity, or I think those are paid directly out of the budgets of those particular agencies, are they not? Aren't they carried there as opposed to within the debt capacity payment?
Representative Solberg and Madam Chair, they are paid out of their budgets, but what our debt practices have not done is accounted for the way that the rating agencies look at our debt. They look at all obligations that are paid out of general fund resources, irregardless of whether they're general obligation bonds or whether they're these standing appropriations or whether they are lease purchase financing. The concept that they use is something that's called net tax-supported debt.
So is that the 5% of for everything that or the 3.5% of personal income, that type of thing?
The way that the guidelines currently work, Representative Solberg, Madam Chair, is that it would be included potentially in there currently, yes.
But, Madam Chair, my concern is you're not carrying those as part of the 3%.
Not currently. No, sir.
But not ever.
Madam Chair, the rating agencies include this in a calculation of our debt burden. Whether we do or not, they do.
So, Madam Chair, that's kind of interesting because we heard you can't go over the debt, but and Representative Pinky and I are on the same page on those two buildings across the within the Capitol here of saying if you're going to do it from state obligation bonds instead of going around the system. To do it, and actually those I think were financed by St. Paul Port Authority, I believe.
Madam Chair, Representative Silberg, I can't speak to what was done when those were approved.
Well, they are the obligation, the general obligations, St. Paul Port Authority, and then leased back to the state.
And they're considered and they're viewed as an appropriation credit of the state. Continue. We've talked a lot about this next slide, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time what projects are eligible for GO bond financing, but it's the same sorts of things that was in Mike's presentation, publicly owned, capital expenditure, public purpose, and the one that we really have a lot of difficulty with sometimes, which is that the purpose must be clearly set forth in the law. On the next slide, too, I went through this really nice long list that's directly out of the Constitution, so you can see that it's actually very specific.
So, Representative Mallory, this is your, remember that question you asked?
Yeah.
This is what she was reading from. Other purposes for which GO debt may be issued, we can repel invasion.
Or suppress insurrection. So. And then at the next slide, we just wanted to talk about a few other important provisions pertaining to general obligation bonds. The first thing is that they are a full faith and credit obligation of the state, and that we have pledged that we will levy a tax, a statewide tax, if necessary, to meet our debt service obligations. Now, in fact, we haven't done that since, I believe, 1966, but that is our pledge. Bonds have, by Constitution, a maximum maturity of 20 years. Each bond issue that we sell, and I think this gets back a little bit to Representative Dean's question too, must distinctly specify the purposes and the maximum amount of proceeds that are authorized intended for such purpose. And we do maintain, pursuant to the Constitution also, a special state bond fund. I'm going to skip over the next slide in the interest of time for you, but it just shows you as of the end of the last calendar year how much debt is outstanding.
And I will say we don't have the slides for this. And then if members want to get a copy of this, we could certainly get it, but it wasn't included in our packet.
Okay, we'll do it.
The other, Mr. Roloff's was, but yours is not. So
it Kurt sent it yesterday afternoon.
If we can get a copy emailed to us.
I think Jenny has it because it was emailed along with my yesterday afternoon. There were two. Bond ratings. Bonds may be rated by one or more of the three major credit rating agencies. There are three, Fitch, Moody's Investor Service, and Standard & Poor's. For those of you for which this might be kind of a new concept, a bond rating is a measure of risk, credit risk, for investors. AAA is the highest rating. A D is a bond that's in default. The two important things that you should remember, actually, are the last two bullet points. The higher the credit rating, the lower the risk to investors, and the higher the credit rating, the lower the interest rate that we pay on our bonds. The next page shows our current general obligation credit ratings from Fitch, Moody's, and S&P. Fitch and S&P are both AAA. Moody's is a AA1. In conjunction with the bonds that were sold today, Fitch revised, rating agencies assign you both a long-term rating and also an outlook. And the Fitch revised from stable to negative with this issue. Moody's had a positive outlook, actually, on the state's credit for about 18 months. They revised their outlook from positive to stable. S&P confirmed the AAA and also confirmed the stable outlook. We also have underlying ratings on the 911 revenue bonds, which I just provided you for some information. You can see they're quite a bit different than the general obligation bonds. And that's one of the reasons why we will often, when we're talking with staff people, talk about the fact that revenue bond financing is more expensive than general obligation bond financing. I also thought you might be interested. I looked up before I came over how many states actually have what we call triple-AAA ratings. We do not have a triple-AAA rating currently, but there are seven states that do. Delaware, Georgia, Maryland, Missouri, North Carolina, Utah, and Virginia.
And on Thursday, we're going to look at the characteristics of those seven states.
Now, the next slide, we're going to start to talk about the cancellation report. And I've entitled this, Project Authorizations Are Not Forever. Minnesota Statute 16A-642 requires the commissioner to report to the legislature on January 1 of each odd-numbered year on all uncommitted bonding appropriations and general fund cash appropriations for capital projects that are more than 4 years old.
And members, the thing that you have in your packet is a letter from Tom Hansen, and on the following pages are the cancellations that she'll be referring to.
Right. The cancellation report was submitted as of January 1. We actually dated it January 2nd of 2009. The report includes all appropriations from 2004 and earlier. All capital projects reported will be canceled on July 1, 2009, unless the legislature specifically reauthorizes the project. I thought I'd take a minute to just talk about the process that we go through.
And are you going to be going over these, or should they just ask you questions?
I'm
going to
touch on it at the end, okay. Briefly.
Because we did see there were some that were very interesting to us, like local road replacement.
Yes.
That seemed to be the largest, which was a bit of a surprise.
And I specifically requested that our friends from MnDOT be here to explain why that did not work very well. But the process that we followed was preparing a preliminary report, basically where we query, I think, the accounting system back in October of 2008, and we distributed the list of projects that had uncommitted balances to the affected agencies and to our MMB executive budget officers who are responsible for working with those agencies. The EBOs then worked with them to try to verify project status. We submitted a revised report to those agencies and to the EBOs in December, and then the final report was prepared as of the close of business on December 31st of 2008.
And these are automatic, and unless the legislature reauthorizes, they would be canceled.
So on the next slide, there was a total of $568,657 of general fund projects that were reported. Bond projects totaled $22,767,028, and of that amount, as the chair correctly pointed out, there were actually, surprisingly, two very large projects, both of which were the Department of Transportation. And the first is the Local Road Improvement Loan Program, just over $16 million. And the second was some projects related to trunk highways, a little over $4 million. And I don't know, would you like to have...
Well, I think that was the one that was most curious to us. And so if they are here,
yep.
I could just quickly give us an explanation of that.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Norman Foster from MnDOT.
Welcome to the committee.
The two items, I think, relate to actions the 2003 legislature did, and I'll try and give a little background. The local road improvement grants, back in 2003, the legislature approved what's been called the Bond Accelerator Program, the BAP program, which was $400 million of trunk highway bonds and $400 million of trunk highway spending. As part of that, it was also a $20 million appropriation of DO bonds, because there are some local components of those trunk highway projects, and it was to make sure there was a tool available to local governments to finance those local parts of the project. These were loans, and so in a few cases, some communities did take advantage of this. I think the balance from the $20 million to almost $4 million was lent out. I think Chan Hassan was one of the borrowers, and I can't recall.
Orono. Yeah.
So there were a few communities that did need this financial assistance to help to make sure their local part of the bigger trunk highway project went forward. Other local communities were able to either participate with property tax money or other financing. So the reason this is showing up now in the cancellation report is because it was a tool that was useful, but the amount was not needed as much as was originally appropriated. The other item under transportation is the $4,008,000. For those of you who may recall back in the 2003 budget solution, $110 million of trunk highway bonds were substituted for what had been $110 million of general fund cash back in 2000 for the Moving Minnesota program. So this was sort of a refinancing of general fund cash. All of the money, the $110 million, was encumbered as of June 30th of 2003, which was the original purpose. So the $4 million you're seeing here is, as the encumbrances unwinded, they came in at a little less than the projects that originally been encumbered for. So they now are up for cancellation.
Is that clear to everyone? They were the largest amount, so we thought some explanation of that was warranted. Thank you for coming.
Yeah,
we may have one question.
The full county grant of $204,000, that appropriation, I think, was $400,000 to begin with. And they've spent $195,000. Why is there $204,000 left in that? Is it that much of a mistake in their estimation, or did they not use it all?
Well, we just know those Polk County engineers are better than
that. I know that.
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, I did notice that it was $400,000. I don't have an explanation for the difference, so I'll get it to you.
Would you please?
But it was $400,000. It was a flood-related bridge replacement, I think. So I'll get you the information.
It was 2003. I don't know if it was flood-related necessarily, but it would be interesting to know why. Usually you don't see that over half of it not being appropriated.
Right. And so you'll get that to Representative Solberg. I don't know if there's any. Would you want to see that too, Representative Leader?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. So are we just about? We have just a few minutes left.
Very close. We talked a little bit about market conditions, but I just thought it would be worthwhile to talk a little bit about some of the things we actually talked about at the bond sale this morning. I have to say, I mean, I've been involved in municipal bonds since 1985, and the last year has been extraordinarily difficult. But here, you know, and even in spite of that, I mean, that second bullet point, something that we call cheapness, municipal cheapness to treasuries at record levels. You know, normally we issue bonds tax exempt, treasury securities are taxable. Over history, there's always been a bit of a relationship between the interest rate, if you look at a 30-year taxable bond versus a 30-year tax-exempt bond, and that relationship has gotten completely out of whack to the point where normally would have been in the 75% to 85% tax-exempt to taxable. We've seen it as high as 225%, which was a puzzling to those of us that have to work in this industry, because there was no good explanation why more people were not buying municipal bonds, because the rates were so much better, even tax-exempt, than anything taxable that someone could buy. So we're hoping that relationship's going to normalize a little bit. We also have seen very erratic institutional demand. When you sell large bond issues like we do, it's important that institutional buyers, and those people would be traditionally insurance companies, certain state-specific bond funds, that those folks participate, because it's a lot of money for just individuals to buy on their own. And so that's been erratic. High credit ratings and plain vanilla structures are definitely getting the most investor interest. That's why our bonds did very well today, I believe. We did delay the 911 revenue bond sale that we were originally going to sell early in October. I think many of you know that. We did end up successfully selling those bonds in November. We ended up changing from a competitive sale to a negotiated sale, and we sold $42.205 million of bonds. That made also our friends at MnDOT and Public Safety very, very happy. And then we successfully sold the smaller issues today. And the last slide is really just something that someday would like to have time to work on. When I was recruited to take this position, I was interested and the department was really interested in things that I had seen and done in other states that we might be able to benefit from here. So I just listed for you just a few items We're trying to completely revamp all of our bond disclosure documents, our official statements. We had a very, very large document that the investors and the credit rating agencies, frankly, couldn't make a lot of sense of. So we're trying to clean that up and present a more straightforward presentation of the state's picture of all of its credit conditions. We even before the legislative auditor's report, I knew that we needed to enhance guidance for state agencies in how they use GO bond proceeds. So while I'm happy to say it was on my list already, it was highlighted again in the audit report. I think it's very important that we develop a formal investor relations program. We have $4.6 billion of debt outstanding, and we need to know who those people are that own our bonds and make sure that they have all of the information that they need. And finally, we have some tax compliance things that IRS is pursuing with government, state, and local, and we need to be prepared to address that as well.
And members, I can't even entertain any questions because the next group is anxious to get in, but the department will be back on Thursday. And I have to say, members, the next meeting is probably, in terms of overview, one of the most important, because we are going to look at that debt guideline. And we would ask you to be prompt, because our next meeting on Thursday is in Hearing Room 5. It will be televised, but because it's the state of the state, it will most likely be for delayed broadcast, so we would just ask you to be on time. I'll just call attention to the fact that in your rule, in your folders, you have committee rules, which we don't have to invoke, I don't think, Deb Dyson's brief on state bonding authorities. You have on this green card all of the staff that you might need to contact, and, of course, all of the members of the committee. And have I forgotten anything? But I would really encourage the next meeting, I would say, will really set the basis for so much of our discussion. So if at all possible, we hope for good attendance. And for today, the meeting is adjourned.